That's the most simple MVP I could have thought of. That's genius. It's crazy. WhatsApp, bank account, poster, done.
That's it. So
no tech, no engineers, no fancy automation, nothing.
Zero. Anyone that comes in and tells you, for example, it's backed on 230-odd million people, only 60 million bank accounts, there's still not enough bank accounts in the country, is not as bullshit. Sorry, that's a falsified story. Certain countries, you need mercenaries, and other countries, you need missionaries.
Okay.
And I feel like in a place like Dubai, you actually need mercenaries, because I remember come Series A, we were speaking to some very large funds, and their criticism was that, you know, a real business. Can you really build this business with debt? And can you access debt in the local market? I was like, good point.
Challenge accepted.
Challenge accepted.
Some people say early wage access as a category is a tax on the poor. People who can afford good living can wait until the end of the month to get their salary. How do you think in terms of net positive on society?
When I had this happen, where we literally had a competition CEO come to our office, and he said, I hate you. And I said, why? He says...
Hello, Internet, and welcome to the second episode of the Rallycap podcast. My name is Kian, and I'm a partner at Rallycap. Today's guest is Omer Ansari, the co-founder and CEO of Abhi. Abhi is one of Rallycap's fastest-growing portfolio companies. They started in Pakistan, then expanded into Bangladesh and the UAE. Abhi had phenomenal growth since inception. They got profitable in 6 months, and as per the recording of this interview, they were generating $7 million in annual revenue. Today, they just hit the 12 million ARR mark. So what's the secret behind Abhi's phenomenal growth? Let's get into it. Thank you for doing this in my messy room. So excited to finally sit and have this conversation. So many questions. Maybe first, for those who don't know you, very quickly, your background and then what Abhi is.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on as the first guinea pig. As part of this, I said, hopefully you have more important people on as you grow this. So happy to support and thank you for supporting us. So I'm Omer, CEO and co-founder of Abhi. Background-wise, I was in investment banking for my sins for about 15 years, both buy side and sell side, always covering emerging markets. My last role was at Morgan Stanley in New York, covering emerging markets and frontier markets. I was a specific focus on fintech and started Abhi in 2021 with Ali, my co-founder. Essentially, what we are a B2B2C lending platform. So think of us as an embedded finance platform that allows both businesses, specifically SMEs, fix their working capital financing issue, as well as their employee base, giving them as a first product earned wage access, branching out from there and basically being a financial solution for the employees of a lot of these companies in markets that the people aren't able to get it. So we're currently live in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and now the UAE.
Awesome. Rallycap invested in you in the early rounds. Could you share some numbers at which growth rates you've been executing at, and maybe a few numbers of where are you at now?
Yeah. So we, as I mentioned, started July 2021. We started off only with EWA at the time. So we had signed up about 7 companies and 10,000 employees at the time. Fast forward to today, we've also added the working capital financing to the business. So we're now in over 750,000 odd employees in the pipeline for coming on the platform, with about 300,000 live on the EWA side. We have over 800 companies now on board. Our book size now is close to $30 to $35 million odd on a rolling monthly basis. So we're very short duration. We're in 3 different countries, and we're doing just around $7 million in ARR and about $2.5 million in EBITDA.
$7 million in ARR, and then
$2.5 million in EBITDA.
In EBITDA. So you're profitable. That's quite rare in the region.
So I remember when we launched, Ali and I sat down and talked about this. We were very clear that we wanted to turn cash flow positive as quick as possible. We did it very quickly. So we did it less than 6 months. So
cash flow positive cash in flow 6 months. Insane.
Look, I'd say it's slightly falsified because we're using equity for our balance sheet, not debt. Had we been using debt for our balance sheet, perhaps we wouldn't have been as cash flow positive as we were. We still would have been cash flow positive, because one thing we also did from the get-go was price our products assuming that we were sourcing debt for our balance sheet, which is very important, because that's where, when the world changed and specifically Pakistan changed, we said that we have to make sure that we are able to grow this business without equity funding and use our real cost of capital, which is debt financing.
Yeah, I'm curious about the whole ideation phase. Did you have 10 ideas you wanted to execute and then started eliminating?
As an investor and now operator, I've always been focused on a credit first solution, because I truly believe that one, payments infrastructure, wallets is done. Anyone that comes in and tells you, for example, it's Pakistan, 230 odd million people, only 60 million bank accounts, there's still not enough bank accounts in the country, is not as bullshit. Sorry, that's a falsified story, because there are enough wallets in the country. If you have an EasyPesa wallet, you have a Jazz Cash wallet, you have a Bcash wallet, if over here, everyone's bank, if you have a WPS provider, you'll have access to a store of value. So that's not really fixing an issue. Second, what is a pain point that people have? It's typically not that, you know what, shucks, I can't send that money digitally, my friend. That's usually not everyone's complaint. It's, I don't have money. I need money. So credit was then the next thing. Okay, what is a credit problem that exists currently in the market that we want to go live in that's done very manually in fashion and underserved? So that's really where we started off with earned wage access. So that when Ali and I thought about the business, I really want to do the SME financing side. He had brought in the EWA side. And we're like, hey, we don't want to do both at the same time because that just sends a wrong message and lack of focus as well internally. So let's do one. And to be honest, we said, which is the one that we're seeing the easiest take up on for us to be able to build out? And it was EWA at first. So I was sitting in New York. Ali was in Karachi. We said, let's test this model, very dirty MVP. This is our own money. So we took our own money. He printed out a poster and we put it in one of the companies that we had signed up with about 450, 500 odd employees and said, if you want your salary in advance, WhatsApp this number with your bank account details and how much you want in Urdu. And within 3 weeks, we had about 40% of the employee base transacting.
That's the most simple MVP I could have thought of. That's genius. It's crazy. WhatsApp, bank account, poster, done.
That's it. So what
no
happened?
No tech, no engineers, zero. No fancy automation, nothing.
Zero. But it's weird. Honestly, it was element of understanding the rails in Pakistan, how efficient they were, was one aspect of it. But to be honest, the biggest aspect of doing this dirty MVP was I was about to quit Morgan Stanley and move my entire family from New York to Karachi and taking a leap of faith to be able to start this. And yeah, that's really where like, okay, how do we really test this out? Very manual fashion to see if people actually want this. And that was our way.
Let's start with a beachhead product, the Wedge, which is this early wage access. Some people say early wage access as a category is a tax on the poor. People who can afford good living can wait until the end of the month to get their salary. People who live in a frugal life have to access their salary earlier, but then there are fees. How do you think in terms of net positive on society to enable blue collars to access their wages, but also get taxed over that?
Yeah. If you look historically, as evolution happened, we de-evolved when it came to payments for salaries. The saying before in Roman times was worth your salt. So you used to go do a hard day's work, come back and be paid in salt for that day. And everyone was a daily wage earner. That moved over time to an employee-based system, which if you think of it from a perverse standpoint, you as an employee actually lending your company money till the end of the month for your services. If you've worked 20 days in the month, you've worked them.
Yeah.
Why do I have to wait for that money to be paid to me? I think this is just democratization of access to your right to be able to access that money. So I think that's one thing that just needs to change. You should be able to, at a click of a button, be able to access what you've earned so far. That's a democratic right for everyone, I think. That's one aspect of it. Two, I'd say that there's always a cost of capital for everything. In an idealistic world, I would want to offer this for free. But what this does, and what I've said is a goal as well for us, is this is a wedge for us to build your user base, to then give them access to other forms of finance that then this you can actually offer for free later. So, for example, in places like Pakistan, Egypt, etc., where inflation is high, it is stupid for you to wait till the end of the month to get your salary because it's worth less. If you can take that money out early and put it into a gold savings account, for example, or you can put it into another form that yields you a better return than sitting in raw cash, you should do that. Now, if I can make money on that instead, that offsets me from a cost of capital perspective, I'll offer it for free. I think as it progresses and this becomes more ubiquitous around the world and people accept it, and as you move people up the ladder when it comes to financial education and literacy, that's when it becomes free.
My experience with Abhi is that maybe 9 months after we invested, I visited Pakistan. I was meeting with all these founders and the startups like, yeah, Abhi, lend us money. And they're giving us balance sheet. I'm like, what? It was early wage access, but then suddenly grew into this plethora of different products.
Yeah.
Was that always clear in your mind? And at which point did you say, you know what? Now that we've penetrated with EWA, let's go and eat the market with these different products. And also, can we share more about how do you keep the focus between building all of these products at the same time?
Yeah, so it's really two products. We're B2B2C, where we service the B as well as the C. So on the B2C side, it is earned wage access. And now we give other forms of financing to a cohort of people that we've been able to see the salary come through. So we're saying, okay, we can give you short-term financing for a smartphone or looking at two-wheeler financing, for example. I mentioned before that we're looking at possible wedding financing as well for some of these individuals. So on that side, but we just view that as really it's EWA. That's really the core of that business. On the business side, it's essentially working capital financing. So to take a step back in terms of answering your question of why we stepped into that, remember, we were always wanting to do SME financing. If you look at all the geographies we operate in, 85 to 90% of GDP of these countries is run by SMEs. But credit penetration for SMEs is minimal. If this is the bedrock for your economy and these companies cannot sustain themselves from a working capital perspective, this is why boom bust cycles happen a lot more frequent in emerging markets versus developed markets. The reason why we stepped into it earlier than I thought we would have was listening to the customer. So what happened was in the first 6 months to 8 months, we onboarded a lot of companies, a lot of employees, and then some of the larger SMEs that we were working with started taking time in terms of conversion. So signed the paperwork, all done. And I go back to the sales team, like, okay, why isn't the employee data come through? Oh, they're stalling. There's nothing's happening. Yeah. We can't get in touch. It's okay. Do me a favor. Set up a meeting with all the CFOs for the companies that we really want to bring on board because I need to understand what the pain point is. So we met with them. I said, how's it going? We've signed. You said you love the product. I said, look, it's a great product. We don't disagree with you. But realize that we have bigger fish to fry. The reason we pay our employees late, which is where you're trying to step in and basically help with earned wage access as well, is because we get paid late. Our working capital sucks. We are squeezed by everyone. Our AP cycle does not match our AR cycle. And so we have to work with the cash we're given or have on balance sheet because we don't get lent to. If there was a way for you to help us, then we'll help you.
Hence factoring.
So I said, okay. So essentially, if we can step in and help you from a working capital financing perspective, which is essentially what you're doing with EWA as well anyhow,
yep,
right? You can then penetrate companies much quicker. And so that was our thesis. So we said, let's try this out. And the moment we turned that on, that's when numbers started going crazy. And it's also a very profitable business. Now, this is also very important for us and why I wanted to do this much sooner than what we did. And the world's changed now. But when access to capital was cheap, a lot of competition started trying to step in our space. None of them exist today, by the way, because what they did was play negative unit economics game. However, what I was able to do, and I had this happen, where we literally had a competition CEO come to our office and he said, I hate you. And I said, why? He says, I know you're making no money on your EWA. I'm like, I know. And because I've got a B2B engine, which is so profitable that I can subsidize my B2C and make it so that it is the platform to go to for anyone. And then as you disintegrate from a competition standpoint, that's when I can build a business even further in a more sustainable manner. That's where it really stepped in on both ends, where we said, I want to, one, have another engine of growth that's profitable, allows me to fend off competition on this side. Otherwise, it just becomes a pricing war. We've seen this happen in Brazil. We've seen this happen in Mexico. You just don't want to get into a pricing war with just one product. Doesn't make sense.
Cool. And then at Rallycap, the reason we've been skeptical about SME lending in general in emerging markets, it always looks good when it's at small scale. But as soon as you grow, your NPLs go through the roof. It's harder to underwrite. You get the first low-hanging fruits and the first SMEs that you can work with. But as soon as you're looking for other ones, then you become less picky and then NPLs go bust. How were you able to scale while maintaining a high quality of standards?
I think we're still early stages. That problem is not there yet for us. It's a good question. And I don't know the outcome. All I can say is I was in Turkey a few weeks ago and met with the founder of Figoparo, and they've built a massive SME lending business in the country in a place where banking penetration is actually very high and credit penetration is very high, but they've still been able to build a massive lending book with very low NPLs. And so my view is that we've been able to do it so far. You obviously look at any SME lender in an emerging market like a Pakistan, you should be looking at your cost of risk being basically around 5-6% on an ongoing basis. It can be lower, but that's really where your NPL will sit. And you should be comfortable with that because your APRs as well offset that. That's where the problem is, also from an investor standpoint, understanding that you need to take on that level of NPLs for you to build a larger book. And we have not reached a stage yet where we've had to worry about that. We have way more demand than we do supply at the moment. So even us being picky right now and keeping NPLs low, we don't have to worry about that anytime. So I think that when my growth starts tapering and doing this, I think that's where I'll have to start worrying about that. But the economy is so large between the geographies we're operating in, I don't think we're going to face that problem soon.
Yeah. So on geographies, it's praiseworthy your ability to just move or de-risk outside of Pakistan. And a lot of Pakistani founders, even the VCs, will tell you, okay, what's the next corridor after Pakistan? They'll say, okay, Pakistan, Bangladesh. Mm. A lot of people talk about it, but very few people did it. And also a lot of Pakistani in my last trip, they're like, yeah, we want to expand to Saudi, we want to expand to UAE. So yes, mentally, I think everyone is ready for those corridors and for startups to expand there, but very few actually do. So first, how do you go to Bangladesh? Who do you know? Which credibility do you have? If other founders are listening and they want to expand to Bangladesh or UAE from Pakistan, yeah, where do you start from?
Go local. So if you look at even historically large companies, forget even startups, Amazon failed going into Brazil because Mercado Libre killed them left and center because they understood local nuances that Amazon just could not even pay for to understand. And so that happened there. Same thing you're seeing now with Netflix in India, for for example. So Jio is now killing it when it comes to local content creation because they really understand local nuances more than Netflix does. Same thing applies for us. Same way how we stepped into Pakistan, where I brought in a strong operational co-founder and our team is Pakistani and understands areas of the country, which I will not. Same thing for Bangladesh. So Bangladesh, we acquired a company called Mitro. They understand the local nuances of how to build a company. And so all I said is that I know Bangladesh has huge opportunity. It's in fact starting phases has grown faster than what we did in Pakistan in our starting phase. What do we bring? We bring experience from a tech standpoint. It's already built. Tech stack, here you go. Risk, here you go. Now, there'll be different nuances of risk within each market, but risk tends to be fairly similar. We'll bring that aspect. Operational know-how. You just go scale the business. Let's give you the operational leverage for you to just go out and annihilate competition and build. And that's my view when you go into these markets. One, go cheap. Two, hire very strong local founders. Give them skin in the game so that their upside is not capped. So that they build, they will make the money as well. If you do not make money for people who you surround yourself with, you will never build a large company. So my view is that's how you go into these markets. You specifically places like Bangladesh. UAE is a different story.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you that. It's like what you said is applicable to yeah. Bangladesh, but then for UAE, yeah. almost any Pakistani or Egyptian founder yes. that expanding to UAE, yeah. hire a country manager. How do you even pick from? Because you can get into short-term opportunist people who want the logo and the resume. They would do it 2 years and then yeah, they leave. Yeah. So how do you avoid the mercenaries and work with missionaries?
I flip-flop between it, but certain countries you need mercenaries and other countries you need missionaries.
Okay.
And I feel like in a place like Dubai, you actually need mercenaries because it's a very capitalistic driven society. It's very expensive. And for someone who is going to come on and build something, you need someone who's a go-getter. And if you eat what you kill, then it works, as opposed to a missionary who may be scared to be able to do that. As opposed to other markets where, okay, you're stuck there, the market's crap in terms from a macro perspective, it's very tough. There are going to be nuances that you have to deal with. That's where you need more, I'd say, missionaries comparatively.
And are they incentivized by equity or do you give them objectives and they hit the objectives and there's a success fee? Yeah. Is there revenue sharing? How do you build the right incentives for them?
So KPIs, equity, cash. Be very upfront in terms of what you're want out of that person, and then just be fair, saying, okay, you hit these milestones, and this is what I'll be able to award you equity-wise, and have that conversation with the person, to be honest. I think do not ever hire anyone across any geography if they're not there for the equity, because if you're building this business, they should want to have equity in the business to build the upside. Also, at the same time, definitely get a very nuanced understanding of the local support structure that's there as well. What I mean by that are the large family offices that are in the region. It's a conglomerate driven, right? So if you can bring a local family to back you and support you, whether that be a JV structure, whether that be advisory shares, whatever it may be, your ability to be able to grow and open up doors is much easier than trying to fight and build by yourself.
One other thing that you did was that you raised a big Series A, and then you used that equity as credit line to be able to propel the early traction for your lending product. And then you moved away from that equity and keep it for growth only by raising debt and a sukuk to be able to lend off that balance sheet. The first fintech who raises sukuk in Pakistan. It's kind of crazy, right?
One thing I tell the team is if you do not constantly feel uncomfortable in what we're trying to achieve and how we're doing it, then we're not progressing and we're not making change in the country. So to answer your point, that's inherent with everything we do, whether it be from the beginning, EWA, to SME financing, to our card issuance that we don't. Oh, no, you can't do it. You don't have an EMI license. Guess what? We just issued cards and we don't have an EMI license. We've been cheaper than every other player in the market and been able to figure out a way how to do it without having to spend through our nose. And so that's core to our thesis and part of our culture. When it came to the sukuk, I remember come Series A, we were speaking to some very large funds and their criticism was that, oh, you funded the book with equity so far. You're not a real business. Can you really build this business with debt? And can you access debt in the local market? I was like, good point.
Challenge accepted.
Challenge accepted. Now, why challenge accepted? Because of twofold. Now I know that this is what an investor will be needing to see as a benchmark for us to be able to build a business in the next level. So you look at Creditas in Brazil, for example, off balance sheet, a debt that they took on, Nubank, 360 refinance in China, you name it, the list goes on. And if you prove that, then that allows you to get credibility and show that you've built a real business. And two, it is important for you to do that because then you know your true cost of capital and how you're actually running that business. And so that was really the first point where I said, look, challenge accepted. This can be done because guess what? Debt capital markets and emerging markets tend to be deeper than equity capital markets.
Well, we don't see it in the portfolio. So half of our fintech portfolio needs debt for a reason or another one. but you go knock on doors for local currency, it's almost impossible. And you go and speak to the landables and the big USD denominated debts, and it's just extremely expensive and just doesn't help with the unit economics. Yeah. What do? You go to Pakistan and you're like, okay, I'm raising Sukuk, I'm a fintech. Who takes you seriously?
You go through the nuances of getting that all done, right? It's very structured in the sense where I said, okay, how do we replicate what's happening, say, developed markets over here? And what is it that it was with our product? Our product, at the end of the day, the exposure that we're taking is not to the employee, it's to the business. Now, is that business a good enough business that would be lent to, for example, possibly by a large bank? And can I ring fence that receivable so that if there is issue with me, because really the reason why a lot of fintechs cannot borrow money from the local debt market is they're like, I don't know if you're going to be around in a year. So if I give you the money and you go lend, but then you don't have enough money to be able for you to run operations, you shut down, I'm left with nothing. So we say, okay, got that. So what you do is an on-balance sheet securitization, but allows you to ring fence the receivables, which they are funding. So that even if I disappear, guess what? You've got to lean on this. So I'll give you, I'll put some equity in there so that it's semi-collateralized, but not a lot. And the rest of it is going to be based on the receivables that I'm getting. And that's the credit risk that comes there. So that's how we got around it. And we understood then that this is also what the local asset managers require from a rating perspective for us to be able to do this. So it's reverse engineering. Say, okay, this is what they need. How do I work backwards to be able to build into that? And at first, the first one will always be costly, right? So I would say this even with our first round of capital when we raised our seed round. It was the most dilutive. And it was like, what are you doing? I was like, I need to prove the model. I have no experience. And I need to use equity to fund the balance sheet. For me to do this at size, I need to take dilution hit now with the idea of proving myself so that later the dilution is less. Same thing with this. And now we're retiring it in November, the first issuance that we did. We already have the second issuance fully subscribed. In fact, oversubscribed, and we're doing double the size. So yeah, it was not easy. Down to the T, in fact, the day we issued the Sukuk was the day Imran Khan got arrested. Our offices got attacked. The streets were in riots. But yeah, we still got it through. But yeah, the point is, it's possible, it can be done. Start small, even if it's from private HNIs, for example, that are willing to build that track record for you with their own capital. You pay a little bit more for it to be able to make that happen. But yeah, my thesis is debt capital markets are deeper than equity capital markets, so you have to tap it.
Yeah. And then another element that I think is quite specific to you guys is the speed of execution, like just going from 0 to 7 million annual revenue within 18 months. Usually the standard startup advice, keep tweaking, find PMF, or work on your retention, and then you can scale. Yeah. But it seems like you've been always on the go from the beginning, and it can get super risky because you grow fast from the very early days and then you switch direction. But in your case, how did you live that?
To be fair, PMF kicked in very quickly. At the end of the day, anyone who's doing a lending business has PMF in an emerging market. You're doing something horribly wrong if you do not know and cannot lend money in a market that's dire for credit. But the payback, of course, is the aspect you have to control.
The common wisdom in emerging markets, it's easy to disperse the money, but it's very hard to collect it back. But in your case, the collection is embedded within.
Exactly. So that's the biggest aspect of it as well, saying that, look, how do you control collections? The moment you get collections right, everything else is easy. There's so much scope for us to build on, especially at this time, because the truth of the matter is this is the time when our customers need it most, because the traditional financial system steps back.
Risk-off environment.
And this is where you build market share. My view is that market share is won in down markets, not up markets. And this is our time to come out the other side stronger, alive, because the cycle will turn. It always does. How long it takes is a different question. And when that happens, I want us to be the player to be able to back and grow in these markets. Yeah.
That's cool. And you mentioned mistakes earlier on. What were the early mistakes, or even not so early, that you did internally?
I'd say hiring. Ali and I constantly look at each other. I'm like, I didn't think we were this bad. Yeah. It's something people like just surprise you negatively, where you're like, I'm sure that person was going to do this right. And I'd say that's been a learning. And that's why I flip-flop between the missionaries and mercenaries. Missionaries take you so far, in my opinion. And there's a reason why, especially I think in financial institutions, right? If you want missionaries and you're going to build a missionary-based company in finance, then you're most likely just going to build an NGO.
Yeah, it also connects to your background. It's so funny because Omer is the investment banking guy. He's the Excel sheets. He's the financial. He's the DCF, right? These are your KPIs. Go hit them. You get your bonus. Yeah. Boom. You're very pragmatic.
Yeah. So I had when I wanted to do this, and why I also was investing in a lot of fintechs, and the fintech founders, which we did invest in late stage and early stage before, were those who came from a private sector background. Because my view is that public sector institutions have failed the lower middle class and SMEs in all these geographies because incentives are not aligned. if you do not pay people well enough, they will figure out a way to skim the system and they will just not be incentivized to be able to make a difference. My whole view of why I did this was I'm taking private sector capital to build a private sector focused company with the ethos that everyone within the company, I want them to walk out of this with life-changing money having worked here. At the same time, I want that our clients are able to access the credit that they deserve. And that changes their life as well, whether it be on an individual level as well as on a business level. But it needs to make sense from an IRR perspective because the world works in IRR. I am sorry. If you're going to build a large business, you need to focus on economics and IRR. If you try and do anything else, like I said, then go build an NGO, build a not-for-profit. Very different business. Go for it. But I just don't believe that's what's going to cause impact.
I love this. So you mentioned earlier that you think you're not growing fast enough. If you had a magic stick and you could wish for anything and it just happens, what would you wish for, Abhi?
For us, as I said before, demand's not our problem. It's supply. If I am able to unleash the power of credit by just having an enormous balance sheet behind me, that would just be game changer. We're doubling the size of our sukuk in Pakistan in a few months. We have debt lines now in the UAE, which is fantastic. We've been able to be the first fintech in Bangladesh as well to structure a local debt instrument for us to be able to fund that. But it's a lot of work and it's hard. If someone just came to me and said, here you go, here's $100 million, for example, as step one, just go and build.
Okay, let's watch this video again in 2 years because I think it's going to happen. And then just to finish off, what does Abhi look like in the future? Is this a loan book that keeps on growing and then you become one of these massive loan businesses that are valued at 1.2 book value, or what's the future of Abhi?
Yes and no. So I believe that you need to, similar like a lending tree, for example, you need to start balance sheet heavy to be able to extract the data from the market to then legitimize it, to then be able to fund off balance sheet. So one, we eventually will be a data stack of credit scoring, which I can then say, okay, you want to lend to these people? No problem. I've got a history on them. Two, I can create it into an off balance sheet play. So I no longer take the risk. I'll say, hey, you out there, you're someone with moderate risk appetite. You're looking for a yield of X. I match you. It's like Tinder for loan origination. That's hopefully with better outcomes. But yeah, I'd say that's the ideal end result for me. I want it to be a good mix. In fact, majority of it coming from off balance sheet versus on balance sheet.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing so openly. I know a lot of founders would want to keep stuff confidential. Very generous of you. Let's have this conversation again in 2-3 years and watch this back. Congrats on the milestones achieved so far and long way ahead.
Thank you.
I appreciate you, man.
Thanks for having me on.